Hey, fantastic fans, I don't have to tell you that you probably feel the most invincible on a tennis court when your mind and racket are completely in sync. I can't exactly help you with your mind today, but I do have the racket brand for you. I haven't really shared this at all, but my Vocal tennis racket literally rescued me 6 years ago when I was at my most vulnerable on court. I'd played with a well-known racket my entire life and my game was at a complete standstill before I tried the Vocal C10 Pro. It was almost like a cheesy scene in a movie. You know, that's how in love I felt the first time I hit with my Vocal. Vocal supported me with finding my new perfect fit with their highest quality collection of rackets and strings and top-of-the-line materials that ultimately helped me find my game again. I demoed my vocals right from my neighborhood tennis shop, or you can even jump online right now and visit their online store at www.vocaltennis.com. That's www.vokltennis.com and experience how Vocal will make a difference in your game. Check out their arsenal of rackets, strings, and brand new clothing line today and receive 10% off your next purchase by using the discount code Fantastic10. Join me in the Vocal family and trust me when I say they're pretty fantastic. Hey, fantastic fans, listen up because I'm about to make your holiday season so much easier. I was searching online and I typed in fantastic tennis gifts, as one does, and the Google gods shined brightly down on my search as I discovered an online store full of fun, inexpensive gifts that you must go check out right now. www.racketinc.com. That's www.racquetinc.com. They have everything you need for your tennis playing husband, sister, doubles partner, USTA teammate, doorman, you name it. I ended up buying a bunch of the coolest antique racket wine bottle openers for stocking stuffers this year. Never seen anything like it. I even picked up a pickleball court mouse pad for my boss because he's convinced he's a pickleball world champion after playing 4 times, so he'll love it. You won't be sorry. Check out racketinc.com and their Instagram page, Racket Inc., today for the most unique tennis gifts this holiday season. Hey, fantastic fans. It's great to be back this week. I'm joined by a familiar WTA superfan. I have Jonah Sobel back on the show. Hey, Jonah, what's up?
Hey, John. So happy to be on here. Thank you so much for having me.
I just said superfan, and I almost feel like that's a little disrespectful to you because you're so much more than a superfan. I feel like you're in that category with the LaWandas and the Lorena Pops of the Twitter world. Like, you are the top echelon of WTA superfan. So I thank you for joining today because it's always fun to have you on the pod. So welcome back, Jonah.
Thanks so much, John. You know I love talking tennis with you.
I love it too. I'm actually really excited to talk tennis this week because this week's episode with the legend, Rosie Casals, it was really eye-opening for me. And I'm a huge fan just like you. And I feel like you and I are very simpatico when we talk WTA because we love it through and through, right? There's nothing we don't love. We love to hate. We love to cheer. We love to talk fashion. We love everything about tennis. But today, what I really learned on the show was the history. And I feel like today is such a great episode for people like us who love it and also people that aren't as familiar with the WTA. I didn't grow up with 60s tennis or 70s tennis or even early 80s tennis. I mean, late 80s is when I kind of jumped onto the scene. When did you start your tennis journey? I know you're a lot younger than me, so it's okay. It's fine. Say the number. Say the year.
The match that got me addicted to tennis was Wimbledon 2007, fourth round, Serena versus Hontakova, the iconic three-setter where Serena came back from the rain delay and cramps to win.
Yeah. No, I mean, gosh, there's so many great iconic matches. But I got to learn and research so much about Rosie Casals this week. It was about the Battle of the Sexes. It was about the start of the Open era. It was the original nine. It was really an overload of information for tennis fans. And this episode is a firsthand account of the history of the WTA and how really a pioneer and a legend like Rosie Casals really helped propel the movement of not just the women's movement, but also how the WTA was created. And so I'm really excited today. So I'm glad we're here to talk about it. So thanks for joining.
Absolutely. It was great to see Rosie Casals on the TV last night at the finals of the WTA finals. I know she was one of the groups too. So it's definitely full circle.
I know. That's so cool. Yeah. The WTA finals obviously just ended. I can't wait to talk about it because you were there all week And Rosie had her own group. I mean, obviously, we're talking about the legendary Rosie Casals with all the Grand Slams we're going to talk about that she won on this episode. So it was nice that they honored her. And I feel like they did it just so it kind of coincided with this podcast episode, which I really appreciate that the WTA checked in to know when my next episode was going to be. And they honored Rosie in this way. So that's really nice. But enough about that, because we have a great episode lined up. But before we jump into it, we have to talk about the WTA finals in Fort Worth, because again, you were there all week, Jonah. I mean, WTA superfan in the house. You had your pick of the seat, apparently, because everyone was reporting that no one was there. So walk me through, when did you get there? What was it like kind of being in that arena? And give me some of your highlights, please.
I'll start off by saying that, of course, Halloween is not the ideal first day to start a tournament. However, from when I got there Thursday on, crowds were in the thousands, completely interested in the matches, and I was so impressed with how engaged they were. The matches were extremely entertaining. Overall, I was so happy with how great the fan experience was. The WTA merch, I mean, come on now. Who wouldn't want to get some hands on some WTA merch, John?
Well, you are rocking a fantastic WTA Finals hat right now. That logo is so good. So yeah, no, I want one of those. Like, definitely. I agree. Where's the merch? We should be selling this all year long.
I mean, anytime you have an opportunity to think to yourself, should I take that seat next to Krejcikova or not? You know, it's a great event.
She was all over Twitter. It was so funny because she's like watching all the matches. She's just right there. I remember getting a text message from you and it was like, who is that? Who's right in front of you? And it was an empty seat. I'm like, go sit next to her, Jonah. What are you doing? Go sit next to Barbara Krejcikova. Talk about anything.
And I will say my favorite part of the entire event was the doubles.
Yeah.
I will stress that the doubles matches were extremely intense. So many deciding set tiebreakers, and watching Yelena Ostapenko lose from match point up and also win from match point up was an incredible fan experience. She is probably the most amazing person to watch live. She may scold her partner a few times, but that's just part of her charm. And I will say that she had more cheers than anyone on the court.
And for those listening, there is no bigger Yelena Ostapenko fan in the entire universe than Jonah Sobel. So take what he's saying within like a little margin, because with that little slice of pie, because he loves his Yelena pie. But who was getting the accolades? Who were the fans just getting behind? Sabalenka really impressed so many people with how she behaved on and off the court. I love that moment where she kind of chastised the rowdy fan that was kind of being annoying to her, and she called them out in the post-match interview. I thought that was brilliant. You know, I love when a player gets to kind of just display their personality, and that's what fans really want. They want the transparency. They want the character, right? They want that. So I did like that about Sabalenka. I thought that was a good moment for her to come out. But tell me a little bit, what was your singles highlight of the entire week? You're there all week. You're seeing all these great matches.
Probably the singles experience highlight was watching Caroline Garcia play Daria Kasatkina. That incredible third set that was over 80 minutes long. I think the third set took longer than the first two sets combined, and it was so high quality with that match point reaching 32 shot rally. You could just tell that the winner wanted it so much and the loser wanted it just as bad. But you know what? For a Saturday afternoon where it was a completely different session from Iga versus Coco on a Saturday night, it was a great crowd. I thought the WTA did a great job given the circumstances as to why they had to have this event. A lot of things were out of their control. And I think that given how Fort Worth was one of the few cities that pretty much did not demand a multi-year contract for the WTA Finals to make sure this event could take place, made it overall a great fan success, especially for the second half of the week.
Yeah, say what you want. Obviously, it was a little embarrassing to see the crowds in that first day. And as you said, it was Halloween. It's, you know, it's a Monday. I mean, that's a tough day to start. I get it. And I think they did rebound nicely. Let's talk about Caroline Garcia for a minute, because you mentioned that was a great highlight. And it was such a great match to get to that final, right? They get to prove themselves. Garcia and Sabalenka ups and downs all year long. And she's at a career high of 4 in the world again. She's back there. And she has really very little to defend at the start of the next season. You know, Australia, like I said, I mean, she wasn't playing her best at the start of last year. So she has a lot of wiggle room to even move up to that 3 or 2 spot. So it's going to be really interesting for her to see what happens at the start of next year. Sabalenka, oh my gosh. How great for her. What a great, I love, again, we talked about the character on court. We talked about her joking about her double faults and about how, you know, it was just like a really strange year for her. And here she is in the finals, really playing some great tennis again. And, you know, the Sabalenka beating Swiatek in the semifinals was just probably a cherry on top for her for the year. That must have been such a mental triumph for her to kind of get through that match. So maybe a little let down in the finals. You know, it was still a good match. It was still a good final, but still really, really fun.
I honestly thought it was a great fan experience. And I hope people can experience a WTA finals sometime next year, wherever they are.
Well, I loved your photos. It looked like you had a blast. So well done, WTA. And I'm so glad you got to experience that, Jonah. That's a really, really cool experience. So before we get on to today's episode, I do want to talk about the men really quick, because there was some great tennis to be had in Paris this past week. And Mr. Rune coming from, I mean, we've been talking about Rune and his climbing up the ATP rankings ladder for some time now. Yeah, of course, put him into the barrel of problematic players for sure. But I will say, beating Hercash, beating Rublev, beating Alcaraz in the quarterfinals, our reigning number one right now, beating Felix, then that 7-5 in the third victory against Novak, it really solidified Rune as a player that's now in the top 10. He's a top 10 amazing talent and someone to watch for, especially the 2023 season. So your thoughts on Paris?
I thought Holger's run in the Paris Masters was by far the most difficult run that anyone could have experienced, ATP and WTA combined, for a title this year. And it was incredible to watch his rise from being outside the top 100 over a year ago to now suddenly having Patrick Mouratoglou as one of his side coaches. And now everything's just kind of falling into place for him to get to number one sooner rather than later, which is a little scary. He said a few years back that his goals was to be number one, and
yeah,
some of us scoffed and some of us said, no way, Holger, you're so immature.
I know, it's so interesting. ATP is really kind of ending the year on an interesting note, because as they go into Milan and they finish up for the year, there's three players that can be number one after this tournament. There's a lot of math that has to happen, but Tsitsipas could end up being number one. He won the tournament in 2019. He could be the first ever to reach number one without winning a Grand Slam. That's like an interesting fact if he kind of goes undefeated in this tournament in Milan. So that's going to be very interesting. His chances are slim, but it's possible. He must win the tournament without losing a single match to become the world number one. Nadal, meanwhile, can finish the year on top of the rankings if he reaches the final after an undefeated round robin stage, or he wins the title. So we'd love to see that, of course. If neither of them complete that, then Alcaraz will finish the year as number one, which, again, is a great story.
It is a great story.
Yeah, we'll see. Jonah, thanks again for joining today. I love chatting WTA Finals. I would love to have you back for our final chat. I mean, we have so much to talk about. The WTA Finals, we just hit a little bit of it. There's so much to talk about and dissect for the year. We are going to have the most ultimate recap episode, year-end finale, coming up soon. But in the meantime, I hope everyone out there listening enjoys today's episode. You're going to learn so much with the legendary and fantastic Rosie Casals.
Please take your seats quickly, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you.
I mean, they always have a big mouth. They always talk a lot. So it happened before, it's going to happen again.
When I say the phrase, the original nine, what comes to mind? If you're a tennis fan, and especially of the WTA, then you know a bit of the history about how nine legendary pioneers of the sport helped kickstart professional tennis for women, and more importantly, how they became ambassadors in the fight for gender equality. Today, we have one of the original nine here with us, so if you're ready for an origin story, I suggest you clear your next hour. Born in San Francisco, California, our guest may have started from meager beginnings, but she'd end her career as one of the greatest doubles players in the history of tennis. Her 112 doubles titles are second only to Martina Navratilova all time. And ironically, she'd win her last career title in 1988, close to home in Oakland, California, alongside the legend Martina herself. With a career that saw her capture 12 Grand Slam doubles titles and make the final of 17 others, including two consecutive singles finals at the 1970 and 71 US Open, this 5'2" rebel trailblazer and on-court entertainer was rightfully inducted into the International Tennis Hall of Fame in 1996. Today, we'll hear tales from a storied career that saw her battle and win tour matches in four different decades, all while looking like a fashion icon in her custom Ted Tingling dresses. Our guest today is the legend, the fantastic Rosie Casals. Rosie, welcome to Fantastic Tennis.
What a wonderful opening, I tell you. I don't think I have to say anything after that one. Great introduction.
Show's over.
Yeah, really.
Thanks for joining. Nice to see
you. Thank you.
I can't tell you how grateful I am that you're here with us today. I mean, going through your resume and realizing all the things you were able to accomplish in the sport was very impressive. Today's going to be very special. How are you?
I am very well, thank you. And so good to see you and meet you and be on your show.
Thank you. You're at home in California, I think, yes?
I am in my bedroom office with my, I'm sitting on my cat because she won't move.
What's your cat's name?
My cat is Harley.
Harley.
Actually, it's a boy, but acts like a girl.
I found it so interesting. You were born in San Francisco and you've traveled all over the entire world and you've been very loyal to the Bay Area for your entire life.
And then let me just say that I love San Francisco and I left my heart in San Francisco. I moved down to Palm Desert about 22 years ago because of the weather. I lived in Sausalito and I never saw the sun unless I came down the hill, where I played at Harbor Point. And finally, I realized that, you know, I had a place here in the desert and I'd come down in the winter, put my shorts on, get the sun out. And it was so nice. And finally, I said, what am I doing? Even though I love the Bay Area and decided to move with my wife, Connie. And so we brought the dogs, the cats and everything and ended up in Palm Desert at Indian Ridge Country Club. Sounds like a really nice ending.
Oh my God, for sure. I'm in New York City. I'm so jealous of you right now. I mean, I can just imagine.
I love New York though. The energy in New York is sensational. I mean, I stayed with Billie Jean and Lana for the 3 weeks of the US Open. I overstayed my welcome, I think, but we always have a ball and it's always so much fun to watch, you know, the Open and get all the energy from New York. It's a lot of fun.
Oh yeah. There's always a dip in the energy after the US Open. So I'm glad you're bringing the spirits today. This makes me happy. We have decades and decades of pro tennis to talk about today because your career, Rosie, is absolutely legendary. 12 career Grand Slam titles, 17 other Grand Slam finals, and 112 WTA doubles titles. But first, I have to make a confession because today is not the first time we've actually ever met. Well, what I'm about to say is going to age me, but it's going to age you too. So I apologize. But I was actually your ball boy for the Virginia Slims Legends Tour when you came to Tampa, Florida in the mid-90s. I was a young kid. I think the event was at Saddlebrook, and I was on court with you for some pro-ams.
That was the Women's Tennis Classics. That was one of them. And actually, my company, Sportsman, put those on. You know, later on, we did Virginia Slims Legends. So that's taking me back to my 30s.
Yeah.
So how old does that make you? Because I can't, I should start yeah. counting backwards nowadays.
Yeah, we'll keep counting. But I do remember specifically you and Virginia Wade being so kind and nice. And not everyone was very kind and nice to ball kids. So that was very nice. So thank you. I was a huge Navratilova and Pam Shriver fan. So that was a big event for me. I was very excited. But can we talk about that Virginia Slims Legends Tour for a minute? It was very cool for fans to watch all these legends show off how great you all still really were.
Exactly. So the Virginia Slims came later in, I believe, something like 1996.
Yes.
And Virginia Slims was great to decide they wanted to revive us and give us a chance to come back and try and play tennis. We did have a lot of fun, a lot of laughs because, you know, with a lot of us like Billie Jean, myself and Virginia Wade being at that point into our 50s and some of the younger ones like Chris and Martina and Tracy. So we said, we don't want to play against them. We want to play with them. So, but we had a lot of fun. We also had part of the music festival. Virginia Slims was doing the musical part with Gladys Knight. So we really did have a wonderful time. And I cannot say enough for Virginia Slims. I know it's a cigarette company. And nowadays, people are very taboo about smoking, and I appreciate that. But if we wouldn't have had Regina Slims, not only with the Legends, but way back when with the original nine and the starting of the tour in the 70s, women's tennis certainly wouldn't be where it is today.
For sure, for sure. I mean, it seemed like a very fun reunion. Even as a kid, I could see how you all enjoyed being around each other, and it was this great energy.
We had a ball. I mean, you know, talking about, oh, can't get to that ball anymore, can't hit, don't do that, don't lob, no more lobbing, no more. But, you know, it is a little traumatic, you know, wondering how are you going to feel. And so it was kind of a nice little rebirth of being fun and being on the court and having people appreciate for what you did in the past more so than what you were doing on the court that day.
Yeah, I do love that Legends Tour really bookended an amazing start to your tennis journey with you being a part of such a special group of women with the original nine as well, which I can't wait to talk about in a bit. So since we have so much to discuss today, let's jump into the career and life of the legend, Rosemary Rosie Casals. Let's take a stroll down Rosemary Road. We'll pop open a bottle and pour ourselves some Rosé Casals. You know, maybe I have some here right now.
I got this. All right. Now I got OJ, maybe vodka in it would do just fine, but.
That's fine. Yeah, I'm drinking some Rosé Casals today.
That's very nice.
We're going to jump into our tennis chime machines today. I've compiled the most popular topics that tennis fans want answers to. The topics today range from the beginning of your career all the way to today at home in the warm desert with Harley. Along the way, I have some fun fan questions for you as well, Rosie. I'd like to start today's show by traveling all the way back into your tennis mind. Do you remember the very first tennis match you ever watched live, or maybe even the first major tennis players you remember being around?
Well, okay. I think I must have been about eight and a half. I had already started to play a little bit. And I remember looking at the TV. This was black and white, Forest Hills. And it was only televised probably the finals. You know, that was the only time you ever saw tennis on TV. And it wasn't very clear, wasn't very good. So, you know, you were wondering what they were saying, and it was never for very long. It'd be maybe an hour of what was going on. So, yeah, that made an impression more than anything. It wasn't particularly one player or another, really. I think at that time, Darlene Hard was playing, Maria Bueno. But yeah, they were the ones that I would recognize, I guess.
Yeah, no, it's so interesting you say that, because I typically ask that question and people first gravitate towards television. And you're right. I mean, television wasn't prominent. Broadcast television really for tennis wasn't prominent until, you know, the late 1960s. And you were already a top player at that point. So that's kind of interesting. Do you remember the first time someone mentioned that they saw you on television maybe? Was that a surreal moment?
Not necessarily, because I think at some point, certainly in the 70s, you know, 73, 74, 75, there was a lot of action on television. And there would be an occasion where you can turn on the TV and see three or four different events going on. And I think that was basically the tennis boom. And obviously, the biggest one being the Billie Jean King Battle of the Sexes and Bobby Riggs. I mean, that really put women's tennis on the map, put tennis on the map. That was the highest viewership ever.
Definitely. Oh, I can't wait to talk about that for sure in a bit. I think a very important part to your story and why people really loved you and cheered you on, of course, because you were so energetic on court and you were such a spark plug to watch. I mean, so fun. But you were also extremely relatable, especially for someone like me who grew up very poor, playing this very expensive sport that we all love so much. You were always so open about how you grew up and with your tennis journey. For those not as familiar listening, where does your story begin, Rosie? How did a young girl with immigrant parents from El Salvador end up being such a tennis legend and inducted into the Hall of Fame?
Okay, it started 66 Grove Street is where I grew up with my great aunt and uncle and my sister, Vicky. And I also have two other half sisters and my dad that I call my great uncle that I call father because he was a father and my great aunt was my mother. And my dad was the one that decided he couldn't play soccer anymore. He was older. And he said, well, I'm going to start playing tennis. And I said, what's tennis? And every weekend, he would put on his tennis whites, his white cap, and get his rackets out of the wooden press. And he would go to Golden Gate Park. And I would bug him, please take me. Finally, he did. Finally, he did. And then he would give me a quarter to go get lost and play in the merry-go-round and not to bother him. But I'd come back early and I'd say, oh, I want to play tennis. I want to play tennis. And then we bought a racket for $8 from Sears. Beautiful. It was a Wilson with blue strings. And I started hitting against the backboard there. And then after he'd finished, I'd come and play. And, you know, he coached me, showed me how to hit the forehand, backhand, and serving volleys and all that. And, you know, I started getting better and better and started playing some of his cronies and playing doubles with him. And, you know, the action of the park was extremely important to me. It was my world. You know, it gave me everything. We had characters that, you know, would show up every day, want to play on a certain court. I had a very nice friend who played with me all the time because as a kid, you were not allowed to get on the court unless you were playing doubles or with an adult. So that's how I learned to play doubles probably more efficiently than I did the singles, even though I loved both of them. You know, I just never remember when I could not hit the tennis ball. It was like a very natural thing. It was thrilling. And I fell in love with tennis. And that's all she wrote.
I love that story. I mean, who's going to guess that a trip to Golden Gate Park is going to spark a lifelong romance?
You know, through grammar school, through junior high school, through high school, that was my place of residence. You know, I made friends that are lifelong friends, and I would never trade my life and how I grew up because I do believe that it was something that gave me confidence to excel. I knew I was good at something, even though I didn't have the clothes that, or the car or the money that everybody else may have had that I was competing against, but I was able to beat them. I did have a tennis game. And I think that, you know, sort of gave me that I'll challenge you anytime, the little chip on the shoulder, a little, yeah. You know, I can do it. I can beat you. So
yeah,
that's one thing you can't have.
You chose right. I mean, there was more money in tennis than being a professional merry-go-round rider at that point. So, you know, good job.
Well, in those times, you know, you didn't think along the lines now where you have the open air and prize money and everything. You played for the love of the game, and that's what got you through.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about it, because before you tackled gender equality in tennis, you first had to deal with a class system in the sport that didn't always embrace people like you, that didn't fit into a particular stereotype of tennis at the time. You've spoken about the disadvantages that people without money have in a traditionally affluent sport like tennis. You once told a reporter for People magazine years ago, and I quote, "The other kids had nice tennis clothes, nice rackets, nice white shoes, and came in Cadillacs. I felt stigmatized because we were poor." Did that feeling follow you throughout your career, Rosie? Did you feel like an outsider in the sport when you first started playing events?
No, I think once I started winning,
yeah,
you know, I think it changed things. It made me feel as if it's okay. And it gave me the confidence that I needed, you know, to excel in a sport that really belonged to others. And I think it was a unique situation for me that made me who I am, that gave me a reason to want to win, you know, because winners are those that are going to be listened to, acknowledged.
Yeah.
And I'm so happy that I was fortunate to have been pretty much of a natural athlete. And things came easy to me. And I was given a physique that was conducive to my style of playing, of serving, volleying. So yeah, that part of it, I wouldn't trade, because give me all the money and the Cadillacs at that time and everything. And if I didn't have my tennis and my being good, then it would be meaningless.
Well, as a self-taught junior, you quickly became one of America's best players. You begin to travel around playing events. And as a teenager in 1962, you'd play an important doubles final. As across the net, you'd play Carol Caldwell and your future doubles partner, Billie Jean King, for the first time. A few years later, in 1965, you'd meet Billie Jean again, this time in a singles final at a tournament in Cal State Los Angeles. And it's where an iconic partnership would form. Rosie, what do you remember about meeting Billie Jean King, then Billie Jean Moffitt, for that first time?
Well, I was playing with Gloria Sigerquist, and we were ranked pretty high in Northern California. And so Pacific Coast was the last tournament on the tour, on the circuit of the summer and all the players. It was the last stop before all the Australians going home and everybody going every which way. So it was a very big tournament that was a very big deal. And we waited all year for that. We would wait to, gosh, I want to play. And I was invited to play, fortunately. And I remember being told, oh, you're going to play Carol Caudwell and Billie Jean Moffitt. And I thought, whoa. And I remember, I've got this iconic, I'm sorry that I didn't bring it out, but I have to send it to you, a photograph of Billie Jean and Carol and myself and Gloria. And I see this beautiful Fred Perry shirt with her monogrammed and all these reefs on the bottom of, and all these rackets, you know, because at that time there were no carry cases or anything, like all these rackets, like six of them. And I'm looking and it's like, God, that's what a real tennis player looks like. That's what a real pro looks like. Look at both of them, you know, wearing Fred Perry. And so we played very well. I think we lost some like 6-3, 7-5, but it was very competitive. And I remember her, Billie Jean, telling me after, you know, she says, you got a lot of talent. You could be good. You can be really good. And I said, well, you know, thank you. I mean, I was cocky. I'm sure I was cocky and I knew that I was good. And I said, well, okay. She says, well, I'll be looking for you next time. I'll be looking for a partner. So I said, okay. And that, I guess, what was it, about 2 years later?
Exactly.
2 years later that I met her. And she'd just come back from being in Australia for about 3 months with Merv Rose, changing her ground strokes and all that. And I remember hitting with her and she's showing me everything that she'd been doing. And I remember her slipping on this court and hurting her toe. And I'm looking at her and said, God, you're just like an old lady. From that point on, that is what I began calling her. Now, mind you, she was all of, I think, 22 at that time or 21. So she wasn't old at all. But for some reason, this comes out of me. And I said, God, you're like an old lady. And that was that. So that was the beginning of a long friendship.
Still hanging with that old lady just a couple months ago, you know, just in New York. I love it.
Old lady. And she was just a little bit older than I, but very accomplished, very accomplished.
You'd play Wimbledon with Billie Jean for the first time that next summer in 1966. What memories do you have from playing Wimbledon that very first year? You didn't win the title that first year, but it was your first time at Wimbledon. What was that memory like?
Well, I mean, of course, she had told me about it. And I've seen pictures of her, especially when she won with Karen Hand-Sussman, you know, and then she had asked me that year before that she said, well, Karen wants to have a family. She's going to quit and I'm looking for a partner. Would you like to play? And, you know, of course, how can I say no? And all the things that I had heard, and she'd already been a winner. So I remember going on a plane. We started in San Francisco, spent the night in New Jersey with her coach and nine kids that they had. And when we arrived in Manchester, which was the first tournament, and it was raining and it was cold and it rained almost every day. And we managed to get on the grass because this is all grass courts. And somehow, I don't know that we won anything there. And then we played Beckenham and then we played Queens. And then we played Wimbledon. So I was gearing up. And I remember specifically just before Wimbledon started, she says, you know, I like to come a couple of days early. And I go to center court, and she took me to center court. And she would sit there and look at this beautiful grass court, which was center court. And she says, I reflect here, you know, before I start the tournament. It was one of the prettiest sights. It was like entering a cathedral. You know, it was silent. It was beautiful. It was, and I love that court. You know, you have players that either love a court or they do not. And I loved it. And I cherished every moment that I was able to play on that center court because it was super, super special.
Well, playing Wimbledon for the first time is very different from winning Wimbledon for the first time. You'd win the first of your five Wimbledon doubles titles that very next year in 1967 with Billie Jean by your side. You'd beat Nancy Ritchie and the great Maria Bueno in that final. By 1967, you'd already won many tournaments, but winning Wimbledon was something much different because, you know, it's Wimbledon and you get to see that center court, and that's your love story where it began right there. Can you describe what that first Grand Slam was like for you, winning that tournament? I mean, was that something you had coveted? You went back the next year and said, I'm winning that title.
Well, I knew that I had the very best partner. So that alone makes you feel as if you better come through. So there was a little bit of pressure, I think, that I felt because I had not been in that arena, that type of matches where she has. So it was super special for me to have won it with her because she had that confidence in me. But I loved the court. I loved that feeling. It was extremely special that she believed in me and that we were actually able to do it and that I was able to hold my part and do what needed to be done, you know. And so I remember meeting the Duchess of Kent at that time, and you would have to do your curtsies because now they've done away with that tradition, unfortunately. I thought it was kind of fun. And everybody would talk about, well, are you going to curtsy? Where are you going to curtsy? Are you going to curtsy at the service line? And blah, blah, blah. But this was extremely special with her because she believed in me. And that's why I think we were able to do so much, not just on the court, but off the court.
Well, you're a quick study, it seems like. I mean, it doesn't take you long.
Well, yeah, no, it was special.
Can we stay on the topic of Wimbledon for just a moment? It would end up being your most successful tournament. You'd make the single semifinals four different times. You'd win the mixed doubles title twice. And again, I said it earlier, I'm going to say it one more time because I have to say something. You won five Wimbledon doubles titles. Five. That's crazy. That's amazing. What was it about Wimbledon? I know, you know, you just gave us a little bit of background where you see this court and it's like, oh, it's like everyone's singing when you're on this court. But what was it about Wimbledon that brought out your best tennis?
I love the British public. I mean, they really were great fans. And you got used to that feeling of solitude and quietness that you have because it was so different from anywhere else, certainly in the States. You know, you have more of a raucous crowd and they talk and they make noise and stuff. But there it was a hush. I mean, in between points, it was quiet. And that's kind of unbelievable that you have maybe 13,000 people there and they're so quiet. And so, you know, the British are very polite and, you know what you're going to have. Yeah, you're going to have a small lunch. You're going to have tea. You know, I was always starving there my first year. You know, I was always hungry, you know, because their portions compared to our portions were so small. And we'd look forward to tea because they had the greatest little cookies and pastries and things of that nature. So I think I gained a couple of pounds then. But, you know, that was Wimbledon. Wimbledon was just a very special place that I don't think there's anything like it.
There's not. It's so special.
No.
Well, throughout all your years playing at the All England Club, I'm sure you have many amazing matches and stories in your brain. We could have another entire hour devoted to your matches. We'll do that another time. Your fan on Instagram, though, the runner Ken Bake had a question about the politics of fashion that played a part during Wimbledon in 1972. They ask, I always wanted to hear the story about the dress you wore with a purple design at Wimbledon. Did you know that it would cause such a stir? What was your reaction when they asked you to take it off? And were you pushing the envelope on purpose? Great question.
Wow, that's loaded. Yeah, I would say I pushed the envelope a little bit. First of all, I had that dress made by Ted Tingling in two. One was a white on white, with the VS being white, mm-hmm. or a little darker, but white. And I had played in that dress in one of the outside courts. And then the purple one was predominantly white. There was more white, which was the ruling. It had to be predominantly white and no advertising. That VS doesn't sell in United Kingdom. So it meant nothing. The advertising, something that meant nothing because nobody would know. They didn't even know it was BS in the beginning. But for some reason, I think when I went on the court, Captain Gibson, who was the official referee, was told, well, she's wearing a Virginia Slims dress. So in his mind, he thought, oh, it's got Virginia Slims. But when he walked out, he looked at me and says, well, the committee has decided that maybe that dress is not appropriate for center court. And we've been asked that you go back to the dressing room and change.
Wow.
And yeah, I don't know that this has ever been done at Wimbledon. I said, why? I said, it's predominantly white. And that is what you state. And there's no real advertising because there's no Virginia Slims. VS could be anything. And I said, there's nothing that says Virginia Slims. He says, well, he was flustered. And he said, but the committee has asked that you go back to the dress. And I said, fine, fine. Okay. Well, I mean, what can I do? I went back and I wanted to play my match. But ever since that point, they put out a notice in all the locker rooms that if there's any question whatsoever with your attire, that please come to the referee's, you know, office so it could be approved or, you know, looked at. So yeah, I mean, that it was a crazy thing. And of course, I am sure that I wanted to ruffle the feathers because I think I'm a little bit like that.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's the story behind that one. And that one's sitting at the International Tennis Hall of Fame in Newport, Rhode Island. I go and see it every year.
I love it. Yeah, I just envision you taking the dress off and saying, you know, go F yourself, but I'll take it off. But you know what?
Well, of course. And, you know, of course I felt how ridiculous. I mean, you know, I see other things out on the courts and they may be far more offensive. So hence all that started with dress codes and, you know, logos not being bigger than this and that. Good. I started something.
Let's talk about dress codes because that iconic Wimbledon moment and the purple dress incident is an amazing segue to our next topic today, which is fashion, of course. Fans wrote in asking many questions about how much of a fashion maven you were in your playing days, Rosie. Rosie, you had such an iconic style about you. It was bright and colorful, and it was so fun to watch. And your relationship with the late great fashion designer, Ted Tingling, who you just mentioned, who designed so many famous looks for you and for Martina and Billie Jean and Chrissy, it was very special. You actually wore the very last Ted Tingling dress at Wimbledon in 1984. I don't know if you know that, but that was his last dress. So
really?
Another reason you're in the history.
Well, you've got a lot of stuff. I need some of that stuff for my book. My gosh, very nice. Well, I mean, look, Philip Morris did a lot to promote women's tennis, fashion. Ted would design to what he felt was your personality. He's been dressing people like Suzanne Lang Lang from way back in the 30s and played tennis himself and was a fashion designer for clothing before he got into tennis clothing. And he dressed Maria Bueno, Darlene Hard, Suzanne Langland, Alice Marvel. I mean, many, many legends. And so Virginia Slims employed him and said, look, we had this wonderful tour for the women. We want to dress as many as we can, make them stars, make them look great. And he did. I mean, for me, he gave me rhinestones and and beautiful velvet. And I mean, some of my dresses weighed 10 to 15 pounds.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. And you had to dry clean them and you had to take care of them. You know, some of the players would go on the court and give me all the rhinestones that would fall down or the sequins. And, you know, my headband matched my clothes. So, I mean, if Serena thinks she has something on fashion, we had fashion back then.
You definitely did. I mean, it was the bandana. It was this encore persona that you had. I mean, it was iconic Rosie Casals style. I mean, some of these pictures, we're going to put them on our Instagram too. I mean, they're iconic. I mean, there's some great ones out there. You have a fan on Instagram, Alicia Monk, and she asks, Rosie, do you have a favorite dress that you wore from over the years?
I did. I love this black velvet with rhinestone buttons all the way down and the Virginia Slims on the left-hand corner and rhinestone around my collar and everything. That was one of my favorite. And I thought I looked pretty good in it. But yes, that. And I had this crazy red, white, and blue, silver and blue, which I wore for July 4th. And it was LeMay.
Yeah.
That was the lightest one that I had. So that was kind of fun. I mean, he made me so many wonderful things. He made me rosebud, you know, with all the little rosebuds and everything. So, I mean, I still have them. I have them in storage. I don't know what I'm going to do with them. I should start auctioning them off for my foundation or something. But
we should. Absolutely.
Yeah, I know. I'm going to use you.
I'm here.
Okay.
I'm here to help. I'm wearing my roses today, by the way. I don't know if you noticed.
I saw that. I mean, you know, that's exactly the kind of stuff that I would wear, you know, because, you know, even though I was shy, you know, I was shy, but I would wear something that somebody would have to comment on it because maybe that's how my shyness got out. I don't know. But it was some great moments. I mean, we had, you know, Margaret Court had her long, big collars and Billie Jean had a different style and Virginia Wade. And, you know, so it was a lot of fun. Everybody was so excited to see what the tour would bring that season.
Yeah, it was a cast of characters. I loved it. Well, we're moving on to 1968 and you and Billie Jean and Ann Jones and Francois Durr, Frankie Durr, signed with a National Tennis League, and you officially became the first professional female tennis players as we know it today. Instead of getting paid under the table as amateurs, you'd earn a salary, albeit a fraction of what the men were making at the time. You had a lot of fellow players that didn't agree with you by signing that contract and how you tried to revolutionize the sport. What was the attitude around that time with the Margaret Courts of the world that didn't have the guts to do what you were doing at the time?
Well, you know, obviously, I think they would have liked to have been the ones signing the contract, getting the money. And like you said, they weren't willing to risk, you know, being suspended, which, you know, we were threatened by the USTA. And it was a giant leap. We didn't know what it was going to bring. We knew that open tennis was somewhere in the horizon. You know, there was so much talk of getting money under the table, how dishonest. And we talked about it. We felt, Billie Jean and I and several of the other players, and at that point, Labor and Rosal and Gonzalez and all those players had been playing all along without being able to play any of the Grand Slams. And so we felt that, hey, we wanted to support honesty and transparency and say that, yeah, we were contract pros. We were supposed to be the best in the world. Why isn't the game opening up? You're still paying the players, even if it's under the table, and the pittance that they would pay you for winning a tournament, Wimbledon, like, you know, you would get a per diem of 10 pounds, if that. So it was very false and not honest. And so I think that we were right in moving forward, signing a contract with George McCall in the National Tennis League, playing with the guys. But I'll tell you what, we were not prepared for what was coming. And that was like a barnstorm. You know, we played in south of France starting in April, May, and it must have rained every single day. I mean, in our mind, we just came from playing in country clubs throughout the summer, having the best of everything for amateur tennis. And then we go into a situation where we're basically flying, driving, taking the trains to each stop. And there must have been like 30 of them. And we were playing almost every night in these godforsaken places.
We're hustling.
You know, and the guys are looking at it and says, welcome, girls, to what real pro tennis is. He said, the most important thing, I remember Pancho Gonzalez, who said to me, the most important thing is this nail and this hammer. And you hammer, and that's where you put your clothes. Because we played in old warehouses or that type where, you know, the court be laid down.
Oh, wow.
Black asphalt. And where the baseline would finish, there would be about 2 inches. So, but let me tell you, the best matches were played. I know Billie Jean and Ann Jones played some of the best matches. We played some of the best doubles matches. The guys probably had maybe 100 people, maybe 200 at a good night.
Wow.
And we're wondering and scratching the women, did we make a mistake here? I mean, you know, did we bite off more than we could chew? And so we persevered and we outlasted everybody who said, you're not going to make it. And that next, I think that same year, 68, I believe, all of a sudden the open era was a possibility with Wimbledon being the first, actually Bournemouth being the first tournament that had open tennis and prize money. So I said, we have arrived.
You did. I mean, you'd find out if you would make it very soon, because you're right. I mean, tennis was really changing in those late 1960s and the early 1970s.
It was way too confusing because you had registered players, amateurs, pros, too complicated.
Well, the pro revolution in 1968 began the start of the open era in tennis. And now we're getting to a part of tennis history that's, you know, for me, I'm a major tennis fan, Rosie, and I've read and I've studied, especially the WTA, since I was a young kid. And I feel incredibly humbled and honored right now because I have someone that lived and breathed this evolution and this revolution of the sport here with me right now. I'd like to get to the history of the original nine now, if it's okay with you. I just want to shut up. And I want you to kind of give everyone listening a little history lesson, because I'd love for you to take us through the story of how in 1970, Rosie Casals and Billie Jean King, and with the help of Gladys Heldman and Virginia Slims and seven other pioneers, essentially helped create the WTA Tour as we know it today.
Well, we started a little bit earlier, like you said, in 68, 69. And all of a sudden, you know, we had always played with the men. So we were playing events alongside the men, and the men were getting more prize money than the women. And of course, that led to a lot of discontent from the women because we felt, you know, we had Billie Jean was number one. I think Margaret Court, Virginia Wade, myself, and Jones, we had a very solid group of ladies playing tennis, and we were not getting our due. And so in 1970, we're, you know, starting to fight about it, talk about it, and leading into Forest Hills and the second U.S. Open. We're very unhappy about the prize money, and we had asked Billy Talbert at the time, who was the tournament director, if he could provide more prize money, etc., and he would not. And so we would meet constantly in the locker room with all the women talking about it. What are we going to do? There's got to be something that we have to try and put pressure on them. But, you know, when you've got all the guys running the tennis, and that's what you had, most of the promoters were men. So no women running tournaments. So they're not going to think that way. They're going to think that the men are the most important. And that's the way they've always thought. And this was during a time we got Gloria Steinem, Women's Lib, burning of the bras, you know, making movements to the Capitol, asking for equality. So I think we became part of that movement in the sports field, joined them, and really started making headways with the media and other women supporting us and supporting the fact that women wanted to be treated as equal, have opportunities in careers, and et cetera. So it kind of snowballed. And that year, we wanted to play, obviously, the Southwest, where Jack Kramer was the promoter. And we went to him, Billie Jean and I went to him and said, can you provide more prize money? The ratio was like 10 to 1. And so we said if we could try and find a sponsor, but we needed more money. And he said, I don't care about the women. The women don't, you know, sell tickets. I care about the guys. And no, we're not going to do it. And we got Gladys Hellman, who was the publisher and editor of World Tennis, which was the biggest magazine of tennis ever. So she tried and got nowhere. And then she said, you know what? Women, I think I may have a location. She had just moved from New York to Houston, and she said the Houston Racquet Club would like to host a the tournament for you. I'm going to talk to the chairman, Joseph Coleman III, Chairman Philip Morris, and see what he can do. And he agreed to guarantee some of the money, but the women, the volunteers there at the Houston Racquet Club, they're the ones that raised the money. They went to their husbands, they went to the businesses, and they said, we need to raise money. And they basically raised the $7,500, and Virginia Slims guaranteed and put some more money into it. And lo and behold, that was the first Virginia Slims. And from that became the original nine women who agreed to play it because we were being threatened that, oh, it's not going to be sanctioned. If you play an unsanctioned tournament, you'll be suspended. They're going to suspend the Houston Racquet Club. So what can we do to be able to make it happen? And so if you were a contract pro and for a dollar, we could be contract pros to Gladys Hellman and we would be able to play that tournament. But that wasn't really the case because they suspended us shortly after we played that. And the original nine were the women that were the nine brave women who took the risk and said, we don't care. We're doing what we feel is right for women's tennis. And I always say, nine women, when do you get nine women to agree on something? And we were also very different anyway. So it was a unique situation that was meant to be for these nine original women to have taken that leap of faith and belief. And of course, we had great leadership with Billie Jean and Gladys Hellman, because that is always important that you have leadership. Because when I look at other women and other associations and sports, sometimes it's the lack of leadership that doesn't get you to where you're going. And we had all the ingredients to take us to where we wanted to go.
Wow. I mean, that story is So special. Thank you so much. I mean, we have Professor Casals in the house giving us a history lesson.
Professor Casals, who I hated school, let me tell you. I mean, that is one thing I never, never liked. But, it's good to get an education, and hence whether you hit Title IX or not, because this is the 50th anniversary of Title IX.
It sure is.
And some asked me about how I was impacted, because I was not. I said, we were one of the influencers. The original nine and Billie Jean and women's tennis really were the influencers to bring to the attention that women had the right to earn a living and to pursue a career, and if it was in sports, and get an education.
Yeah. By the way, that first event, I know you're quite humble, but that first event in Houston, who else than Rosie Casals winning the very first tournament? I mean, at the Virginia Slims of Houston.
It's always nice to be a first in anything. And I won't forget that. I beat Judy Dalton, I believe, in three sets. And I'm so happy that I was able to win that. And even though I didn't make a lot of money, I think it was about $1,500. That was probably $1,500 more than I would have made at the Pacific Southwest. And it was $300 more than Stan Smith made at the Pacific Southwest winning the men's singles. So We made sure we made more than the men.
Come a long way, baby. That's right.
Absolutely.
Well, we're sticking with 1973 real quick, because it was a big year for women's tennis. We apparently felt very lucky in Houston, because it was also the place where Billie Jean King would make history and defeat Bobby Riggs in the Battle of the Sexes match. We could also have an entire chat about that match and how it inspired and affected the entire movement. And you had a lot of questions surrounding this first event. But your first question, a fan from Twitter, HawkeyeWTA3, asks, what was it like actually calling the match from the announcer booth with Howard Cosell? I read an article that they were pushing you to be the Bobby Riggs hater in the booth.
Absolutely. Yeah. I got such bad hate mail after that, because, I was calling him whatever I said about him, male chauvinist pig, and went and went on and on.
You're speaking your truth.
I was. And it was definitely an interesting commentary. To begin with, Howard Cosell, being the biggest thing on ABC and sports, knew very little about tennis. He really did not. And so when I would contradict him, when he would make a statement and I would contradict it, he would look at me, and the guy in the ear would tell me, ruin Arledge. I don't think you should contradict them. Just stick to your story and you can say what you want to say. But, but of course, me, I would ruffle feathers, as you know. And he was pretty male chauvinistic himself. I think he did not want Billie Jean to win. And seeing it from there, I wish I would have been down on court.
I wondered, because it's such a big difference to have a friend and your doubles partner, and you wanted to be there kind of rah-rah.
Yeah, but I think we were looking at what an opportunity for me to be able to be a color analyst on one of the largest tennis events ever with Howard Cosell. And I think my agent at the time said, you need to do it. And I thought, well, yeah, that is true. Where would you get that opportunity? And most likely got paid. And so at that time, you're looking for money too, because you're trying to earn a living. I'm sure I did it because of that, but it was a rough going, because originally I was supposed to be doing it with Jack Kramer. But what happened is,
we don't like Jack Kramer. No, that wasn't going to happen.
What happened was that Billie Jean said to Runa, if he does it, I will not show up. I don't care what happens, I will not show up for the match. And she meant that. And up until that night, Kramer was supposed to be doing the commentary, because we were supposed to be on the Battle of the Sexes on the court and off the court. So last minute, they bring in Gene Scott. He came into the picture and we sort of didn't really bounce off one another in the way that it was supposed to. And so it really was not a comfortable situation being a color analyst in that particular situation.
Well, it was a great movie. I bet that was kind of fun to kind of watch you on screen. That was fun.
Yes. It was weird. I saw it three times. On the third time, I thought it was fine. But it's weird to see yourself portrayed and you wonder whether that's how people look at you, because you look at yourself totally different. And because you only have 2.5 hours to put the history of women's tennis, some of the things didn't match up because of the WTA being established in 73, not 70. And, so that bothered me. And I was told, you're looking at the wrong thing. Those things don't matter. Is the story out there? Did it tell the truth? You know, everything that you would have thought was important, was it shown? And I said, you're right. I understand. So on the third take, I loved it.
Yeah, but you know, Professor Casals wants to get it right. You know, that's how it goes.
Well, yeah, but if it was a documentary, then it has to be correct. But movie, you take liberties in how you portray, and the importance is, did it come across the way it needed to in regards to the general public? See, when you're the insider and you know things more than somebody else, then you know what the truth is, or so it's a little different.
Well, history was made after that match, for sure. It still felt to this day. It still felt to this day, for sure. A lot changed, you know, since 1973.
There'll never be anything like it. And even though McEnroe has challenged Serena and Connors has challenged Martina, not the same.
Agreed.
Not the same.
Well, that match in history behind it. But another major event in 1973 was the scene of your biggest title of your singles career. That was the 1973 Family Circle Cup. It was the first women's event with a six-figure purse. You'd beat Billie Jean in the semifinals and then Nancy Ritchie in the final, 7-5 in the third to win that title. Just another entry in the history books for you, Rosie. What was that first expensive gift you bought for yourself with that prize money?
Well, okay. So I took my money and I was playing team tennis in LA for the LA Strings. And so I came down Wilshire Boulevard toward Rodeo, and I see the Mercedes-Benz dealership on the right with this beautiful red rose. Just beautiful. I go right in there and I said, how much is that car? I'd like to buy that car. Can I, you know, went around $21,000.
Wow.
21,000. Now, I think that's 121 now. But at that time, 21,000, I bought it, went out of the dealership with it. And I loved that car. So did Martina. She looks at me and says, wow, that's a beautiful car. And she goes and she buys her silver one. So I think I should have worked for the dealership. But that is where I spent my first prize money.
A 2-for-1 with Martina. I love it.
Yeah,
you could have got a deal.
Well, she was flashy too. She liked the good things in life. And who doesn't when you come from certain areas and you haven't had it? So you need a little flash.
I agree. Exactly. Rosie, another fun change in the 1970s was team tennis, like you just mentioned. And you were a staple throughout the 1970s and 1980s. Ooh. You played hundreds and hundreds of matches for some fun teams. Like in Detroit, you have a fan, Tim Ross. Hello, Tim. He loved watching you play for the Detroit Love. But you played for a ton of teams and you even coached the San Diego Friars. I mean, you were a staple in team tennis. Can I ask your opinion on something? Because I realize now, hearing all of this too, and how you had to hustle and you played all these matches and you're touring around, you're playing on asphalt. And, you know, what you and Billie Jean and Martina and Chrissy all helped do to build a tour. It took a lot of time. It took a lot of effort and it took risk as well. And it seemed like you played singles and doubles every week and you barely took any time off. And these days with the WTA Tour, players don't play as much or as often. I wondered, aside from the money aspect, which I know obviously is a big component of what tennis is today, why do you think it is that we don't see players playing singles and doubles regularly like you guys did?
Well, okay. In the beginning, of course, because of the prize money and the fact that you needed a program. So all of us, when we started with the Virginia Slims, we had to play singles and doubles. That was just part of the deal. And you had to make it if you wanted to make ends meet. You had to get the semis or finals or win the doubles in order to be able to afford traveling, staying at hotels. Because today, I mean, the promoter pays for the hotel till you're out. They give you a per diem, considerable per diem. And obviously, the prize money is quite different from where we were. We were in the beginning, started with 10, then we got to 25, and we thought we were rich when it was $50,000 in prize money, and the championship was $100,000. Now, the championship in Fort Worth, and I think it's, $3 million. I mean, what can I say? I'm happy for them that they have the prize money. It presents a slightly different situation. As you said, they are more specialized. Now you have doubles that's become specialized in both the men and women and the singles. And because of the way it is, it's hard to play both if you're not in the singles, you know, and you can't qualify in the regular tour. It's hard to play doubles with somebody. I think that's kind of what Goff and Katie McNally, why they're not playing together. But I think also we had to play every day. We had to travel. We had to do media. We had to play pro-ams. We had to give clinics, because that is what we had to do in order to survive and promote and bring women's tennis to the forefront. Now it's different. It's global. We have social media that get things out right away, so everybody knows. So it's a lot harder to keep track. There's a bigger group of players playing, both in the men and the women. So the draws are larger and certainly tougher. And they have to come out, you know, from the very beginning. I've been watching Guadalajara. I was watching San Diego. I mean, they had qualifiers that could have made a main draw. They were so good.
Yeah. Emma Raducanu. There we go. You know?
Yeah, exactly.
Great example.
Exactly. So, you know, you got more competition and they're more global. I mean, they're traveling. They went from Poland or Czechoslovakia to San Diego. From San Diego, they're in Guadalajara. And so that, you know, is quite different from us, where we didn't have the means to be able to go back and forth. Like now you can play the French, come back home, go back to Wimbledon. We had to stay because we didn't have the means. And so, yeah, they're quite a difference. And I think that also they've sort of gotten accustomed to getting what they're getting without much thought as to how they got there. And that comes with knowing the history of women's tennis. I think I'd like more of them to know more about it. And I think WTA is making a better push now to educate them and give them a sense of history as to why they are as successful as they are now.
How are they doing that? What's the new initiative?
Well, I think they're reaching out more and the Players Association to make them understand. And because also all these celebrations have come up, you know, the 50th year of Title IX, 52nd year of the original nine, which was 2 years ago. Next year will be the 50th anniversary of establishing WTA. So I think history is kind of in the forefront right now. And, you know, you do have to reach out to these younger players and make them understand that they have something to uphold and a legacy of theirs to leave. And I think this is more important. It sort of has died out with every generation. You know, Chris and Martina understood it because they were under our tutelage, and it was still important, and it's still important to them. And I know that they do the best to promote that. So I think today's generation needs to know more about the past so they can continue and leave their legacy.
Well, I'm learning so much about the past. I have a good idea of who they can have teach this class. I think Professor Casals is going to teach a great history lesson to these newbies on tour. So
I don't know.
Well, we are wrapping up today with the legend Rosie Casals. But before we go, we must go through her catalog of amazing highlights. We've spoken about many of them already with Wimbledon and the Family Circle Cup, but there are so many. So I was thinking to quickly touch on a few of them and get your thoughts. And if you have any great stories, feel free to jump in there. You're regarded as one of the greatest doubles players of all time, but you'd reached number three in the world in singles, and that was mainly in part to your early success at the US Open by making back-to-back finals in 1970 and 1971, including an epic three-set final against Margaret Court in that 1970 final that you almost got. You were almost there. You've been regarded as one of the most creative players in tennis history as well. A fan on Facebook, Brooke Leach, asks, looking back now, is there anything you would have maybe done to change your approach to your singles game or maybe alter your game style to help you win more singles titles?
If there was any way that I could have been taller.
Same. I'm with you.
5'2¼", and I add the quarter because it's important. I think the style that I played and grew up playing, because we were Californians, our surface was pretty fast, you know, hard court. And as time went by, the game slowed down because here came Chris Evert with her two-handed backhand and her ground strokes that revolutionized and brought ground stroking and backcourt tennis to the game. And I think the style compromised me a little bit because everything had to be so accurate. My serve, my volley. And even then, I think I was probably one of the shortest players on the tour. And I think it helped me and it hurt me in certain ways. That extra inch, you know, Billie Jean's 5'5", and she would be considered short because here comes Martina, 5'7". I think Chris was 5'6". I think Martina's 5'8". So, you know, the game was starting to change as I was already developed then. So it made it a little bit tougher to be able to play. We were never ground strokers, and our grips, unfortunately, with a continental was not really a, you know, grip for hitting the ball and being good at the stroking. But we made adjustments as we came along. But I think my height probably hurt me the most. I think my lack of discipline in the beginning hurt me the most. Like I said, things came so easily for me. And so maybe my lack of practicing and dedicating myself to this is it. Billie Jean was very good at doing that and certainly mentored me and showed me, you know, that I had to make changes in my way of thinking and approaching and stuff. But I think if I could have done anything differently, it would have been to work harder, even though I thought I was working harder. But like I said, things came so easily and I enjoyed myself and I always had a good time no matter where I went. You know, there had to be a dinner, there had to be a party, something going on. And it was me that instigated it. I don't have too many regrets. I mean, I would have liked to have one grand slam. I mean, I look at today's players and that's it. They one grand slam and that, like, what happened to them? Or maybe it's two and it's commendable, but I like to look at myself that I had longevity, that my contributions were both on and off the court. I can never, ever want for what I think the original nine and being part of history and knowing that you had something to do with elevating women's tennis, women's sports and women and just being part of history. I mean, where can that happen? I mean, everything has to be aligned. You have to come at the right time. And I did. My moment was then. And hopefully I'll have another moment sometime later.
Your last Grand Slam, Rosie, would come in 1982 with Wendy Turnbull, who you had a great partnership with, the Rabbit and the Rosebud playing together.
Yeah, that's it.
Were there any players on tour that you didn't get to play with that you wish you had?
I think I played with most of them, obviously, my good old partner, Billie Jean. I played with Martina. I played with Chris. Chris and I did well.
Yeah.
I had played with Margaret at some occasion, not a lot. I played with Virginia on some occasion, but not a lot. But no, I think I chose well, as they did. And we had some good moments. I enjoyed playing with Martina. I enjoyed playing with Chris. Chris was fun. She would always say, "Don't you lop." Because, you know, her being up at net, she hated if I would lob and it'd be short because it'd go after her and she'd, "Don't you lob." So she was fun.
Well, one player that you didn't get a chance to play with, at least in your era, but you recently just hit with is Venus Williams, because Billie Jean posted an epic photo of all of you on court.
We're all there. We were all there in New York during the Open. We looked over, we had gone over to hit some with Lana and Billie Jean and stuff. And I see Venus over there. And we had played with both Venus and Serena when they were about 9 and 10 or 11, something like that, at Family Circle. And, you know, we were already past our prime, Billie Jean and I. And we both looked at one another and say, even though Venus was getting all the notoriety and Serena was quite quiet. And I said, you know what? I think Serena is going to excel, because there was something about her. She wanted to be a star, but she said very little, but she did a lot on the court.
Mm.
And so we did get to play doubles with them. but they were little kids.
Who was your partner? Who did you have to Venus? Did you pick Venus?
I played with Venus because I needed somebody tall to go after those lobs.
That makes sense. That makes sense. Well, you played for so long. I mean, your longevity was truly amazing. Towards the end of your career, you were still one of the best doubles players in the world. And in 1988, you played with Martina Navratilova and defeated Hanna Menlikova and Jana Novotná to win a tournament in Oakland, California. A legendary match. Do you remember anything from that match? That was your 112th title. I mean, that's crazy.
That was a great occasion, because to be able to do it at home, you know, I mean, it was great that Martina could play, because Shriver at that point was not going to play with her. So she said yes. And I'm glad that she had enough confidence, but she was so good that she could carry me if she had to. And what a way to go, to be able to retire winning and to win with, you know, the best. at the time, and in your hometown. So it was very special. All my family, friends, and people that have seen me play throughout the years in Oakland, many, many years, the first Virginia Slims of Oakland, World Team Tennis in Oakland, Coliseum. So I have a lot of memories of that place. And very special moments that I obviously cherish. And I played again that following year, but lost in the finals with Martina. But they were very, very special moments.
Yeah. You'd end up playing your last event in a place that had a lot of meaning for you. We talked about it as well. It was at the Family Circle Cup, a tournament you had won back in 1973 that helped get that beautiful car. And, you know, here you are later in 1991, from 1973 to 1991, and you're still playing. Was that an important place for you to play your last match? Had you thought about ending your career in Hilton Head for a while?
I don't think I wanted to think about ending, you know, because I knew there was something else. But, you know, obviously all good things must come to an end. And that was a beautiful place for me to end because I loved Hilton Head. I love Family Circle. They were a wonderful sponsor. And Jack Jones and John Moreno, who were the promoters, were very nice to grant me a wild card for the last time. And yeah, it was very meaningful to me to have the fans there, to be a part of the history of that tournament. And it was very special. All those things are things that you can't buy. You just can't buy. So yes, beautiful.
In 1996, you were rightfully inducted into the International Tennis Hall of Fame. What was that weekend like, Rosie?
Crazy.
Yeah.
I heard about it, and we actually were playing in the Legends, Virginia Slims Legends. So everybody kept on telling me, you know, you're going to be inducted in the Hall of Fame. How do you feel? And, you know, it's a great feeling to be acknowledged by your peers and to end up knowing that you are in that Hall of Fame that is so special and housed so many wonderful legends and players of the past. To be acknowledged that way and honored is something extremely special. I mean, I've been fortunate to have such a wonderful, wonderful, how can I complain? If you're going to not bring up the fact that the original nine finally got inducted, because that was something that was very special, not only in 96, but that was extremely special last year to have the nine there. We fought for that one as well, because at that time they were not honoring or inducting any groups. So we're the first group to ever be inducted, probably the last group, because now, as I say, Billie Jean, myself, and Nancy Ritchie are the only ones to be inducted into the Hall of Fame twice.
Hey.
So now I'm looking to how to get inducted a third time.
We call that a trailblazer. That's what you are. That is what you are. Is there maybe a match or a moment from your career, Rosie, that you look back and you think about the most? Maybe a moment that comes to you at night, or like in a dream, or when you wake up and like a flash of something. What comes to mind the most, you'd say, over the years?
That I should have won the match against Margaret Court to give me my grand slam.
Damn straight.
I had played well enough and somehow she snuck it. And that's the match I think that I needed to have won. But like I said, hindsight, that will not derail the feeling that I've had of having tennis in my life, having made the friends that I've made, traveled all over, and continue to remain in tennis, which is still very important in my life.
You do. You continue to remain in tennis, and you're still working today with underprivileged children, and you helped create an amazing nonprofit organization called Love is Love Tennis Foundation, which really focuses on helping kids in the Coachella Valley. I mean, you keep giving back. I mean, you've been surrounded by tennis since you were a kid, and you know, today you still kind of pay it forward. And I think it's so lovely. It's really great that you're in the desert kind of teaching people still, you know, at the Professor Casals is still in class. You know, I love it. Well, we're ending today with a fan question, Rosie. And, you know, you've been a pioneer and you're a trailblazer in so many fashions. And we've talked about so many ways that you've put your dent on the tennis world. But you have a fan on Facebook in Rotterdam, Holland. Her name is Anne-Marie de Jong. And she asks, as a gay woman, I wonder what it was like during your playing days to have to hide your true self. Do you feel like you would have been able to be an even better player if you could have expressed yourself differently or been able to live and love freely?
Well, I wish I could answer that because I wouldn't know if I wouldn't have done it at the time. But because of the times, obviously, and where we were with women's tennis, trying to make it go and Virginia Slims and getting sponsors, of course, you could not talk about your personal life, you know, that you were gay and that you prefer women to men and your lifestyle would be different. But everybody who played, and that was what was great about the tour, knew about you and your life. You didn't have to say anything. You didn't have to hide from them. You felt safe. Locker room was the locker room. That was your sacred place that you could talk about things or be what you wanted to be within reason. And I applaud the players because we protected one another and kept these secrets because they were important to keep. But everybody really got along knowing what your preference was, what your lifestyle was. And yeah, it was tough in the 70s because, as I said, we were trying to promote women's tennis. And anybody would be thinking, oh, you're just a bunch of gay women. We can't have any of our kids come and play because that's how they thought. A Tracy Austin or a Andrea Yeager, these young girls coming into the locker room and, oh my God, you know, and then Chris comes along and she's always wants to know what's going on. She's nosy as anything. Lovely person though. And she would, well, what do you do? What do you mean? And she would ask all these questions. And see, Billie Jean would be the one to talk. She doesn't, you know, she would tell her things. She would answer questions. She would, and she was only all of 17 and 18. But, you know, she accepted us, protected us. And we did the same for her when things were going not so well in her personal relationships and stuff. We all did that for one another. We were all very good friends. That's why we were like a family. We still see one another and feel very close, even though we don't see one another every single day. The only one I see a lot is Billie Jean, you know, Alana, who come here and stay, and we go over there and we spend a lot of time with one another. But, you know, it was a great time for us, regardless that we could feel comfortable within our group of players and people that worked there that were not judging and supported us. Beautiful time.
Oh, wow. You know, I feel very moved and very honored today. I can't thank you enough, Rosie, for joining us. I mean, I feel like I'll be thinking about today for a long time. I can't thank the legend, Rosie Casals, for joining me today. It was absolutely an honor. If you'd like to send Rosie any well wishes, you can send them my way and I'd be happy to pass them on to her. If you'd like to learn more about Rosie's amazing organization, Love is Love Tennis, please visit their website and consider donating at www.lovelovetennisfoundation.com. If you're on Instagram or Twitter, shoot me a message at John Garica and let me know who you're a big fan of and who you'd like to hear on an upcoming show. Also, please don't forget to follow us at Fantastic Tennis Pod or on Twitter at FanTennisPod. And if you're listening to us on Apple Podcasts, I definitely appreciate a great review to help keep this show on the air. My name is John Garica, and thank you for listening. This has been Fantastic. We'll be right back.